Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Thank Godzilla. It's Friday, where it is Friday, and that means it's Godzilla. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I write for The Wrap. I write for Decoding Everything, hey. And everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I am a senior staff writer. At Slash
Ooh.
Film.
Ooh, that's nice.
Got a new title. It feels Ooh, good.
Yeah, that's good. Put that on a business card.
Oh, I should get new business cards.
You should get business cards.
I should get square ones. You know, they'd be like really arch about it.
That's very cool, yeah.
But have it like printed in a diamond shape.
Ooh.
Even better.
People will remember you.
Yeah. As the asshole like with square business cards.
Anyway, this is our podcast here at the Critically Acclaimed Network, where we're reviewing every single Godzilla movie and every single Godzilla adjacent movie, which is relevant, after a brief detour last week where we reviewed Roland Emmerich's Godzilla from 1998, a movie which
still isn't good. It wasn't good at the time.
No,
it hasn't stood the test of time. It's still as clunky as ever.
It's not quite as epically awful as some people give it credit for. It's merely bad.
Yeah.
But it was a weird detour. It required a lot of unpacking. But that movie, because we're committed to doing this in chronological order, which we've screwed up multiple times, but we're trying. Because we're committed to doing this in chronological order, we had to split up the Rebirth of Mothra trilogy,
mm-hmm.
which we finally get to conclude in today's episode, where we're going to be talking about Rebirth of Mothra 3. To recap, Godzilla died,
mm-hmm.
but they still wanted to make monster movies, and Mothra was the second most popular one. So Mothra had her own movie in the 1960s.
Oh, yeah.
But then quickly got swept up in the Godzilla fervor and that whole universe. But Mothra got their own movie. But this movie was much more in the vein of the late Showa era, a lot more focused on kids. And indeed, that has remained the case throughout the entire Rebirth of Mothra trilogy. But kids' media in the 90s had a slightly different vibe, a slightly different tone than it did in the 70s. And
it was pointier. Things were pointier.
Yeah. It was very slick. There was a certain degree of artificiality that, to be fair, most of these giant monster movies have a degree of artificiality to them. Mm. But it's a very familiar kind of artificiality. A very late afternoon live action TV.
Yeah, to people our age who were raised watching the Mystic Knights of Tir Na Nog.
Mm-hmm. You know, Power Rangers is still kind of going. Like, kids still watch that
show. That's true.
Yeah,
Power Rangers started up in the mid-90s. I was in high school when it started. Yeah. And I remember,
at least in America. I don't remember if we had it. I think it might have had it through a little earlier.
Oh, I think it was going on for much earlier than that in Japan, but
it had its antecedents in stuff like the Japanese Spider-Man and Kamen Rider. And,
oh yeah, yeah. That whole tokusatsu thing was like established in Japan, and Power Rangers was the first big hit that they imported, not just imported, but like remixed for an American mm-hmm. audience. They shot new American footage with American actors, but they used a lot of the Japanese footage as well.
Yeah, which gave them a lot of production value, but saved them a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it was huge. And all of a sudden, what was... And to be fair, like, Americans had been, like, importing media, often stuff that they could redub to, especially kids' TV, for a long time. We'd already had Astro Boy, Speed Racer.
Yeah.
In the 80s, we would get stuff like Battle of the Planets and Robotech, a lot of anime that would be redubbed and marketed more to kids. The 90s would also have Pokemon and Digimon and Yu-Gi-Oh!
And Sailor Moon, all those.
Right.
Yeah.
But the live-action ones had a particular vibe, and by God, the Mothra movies have been catering to that. The first one saw Mothra and the Elias, the two
fairy ladies,
teaming up with a couple of kids who don't actually contribute that much to stop their evil sister, Belvira, from teaming up with the villainous Desghidorah, not to be confused with King Ghidorah, different Ghidorah.
Desghidorah was the first movie.
Yes.
All right.
Save the day. Second movie. The Elias teamed up with a bunch of kids who, again, didn't do a lot.
Different kids,
to find a treasure in a lost pyramid and help Mothra defeat basically a giant stingray monster, which it eventually did by turning into a bunch of little Mothras and shooting itself into its colon. Kind of a weird film.
Dagara was that creature.
And then in this third film, they're going to team up with some kids to defeat actual King Ghidorah.
Yeah. No gossip, straight up King Ghidorah.
Yeah, a different version, different reality, not the same backstory, but they're calling it King Ghidorah, it's King Ghidorah.
Although we're on to tertiary Mothras at this point.
Yeah.
Because Mothra does get reborn. Mothra is a character that is constantly transmigrating. Mothra dies, but then Mothra's soul goes into like the next iteration.
Yeah.
Which is a caterpillar, and then the caterpillar will pupate and turn into another Mothra.
Yeah.
And it's all Mothra.
And occasionally Mothra will turn into a more badass Mothra, but yeah.
Well, in the rebirth of Mothra, that's when we get Mothra Leo. We get a little fairy Mothra, which is a little teeny tiny Mothra.
Well, that's in the first rebirth
in
of Mothra.
In the rebirth of Mothras. And, and Toho is shameless about this. When they sort of rework one of their monsters a little bit, they'll repackage it and rename it as if it's a new monster.
Yeah.
So Mothra Leo is not the same as Mothra.
No.
And in this one, we'll have like three Mothras, I believe.
Well,
it's the same monster, but
it gets a little funky.
Yeah, yeah.
And to be fair, the Mothra Leo is because Mothra doesn't just get reborn like a phoenix from the ashes. Mothra lays eggs. Those eggs awaken. Become giant caterpillar monsters. They defeat bad guys. One of them dies off screen. Never explained that one, by the way. And then they become Mothra. That other, their previous Mothra, dies. This, in Rebirth of Mothra, was the first time we actually got Mama Mothra and Baby Mothra on screen at the same time. So it wasn't so much that it was being reborn in a new body as it was, this is properly a new Mothra.
Yeah, yeah.
But regardless, Mothra, the gig of Mothra has been reborn. You know, Mothra is dead, long live Mothra. In this movie, and I appreciate one thing about this movie. This is a trilogy. They're not terribly deeply connected. But this one does have a certain air of finality because
it has
a much bigger
story this time around.
It has a bigger scope. It has a bunch of kids who also don't do a lot. But it actually brings the story of the Elias and their sister Belvira to a certain conclusion. It's not just yet another adventure. It actually involves a certain degree of character development, which makes this one a little more satisfying, I feel. Belvira goes through some shit, and so does, is it Laura, the one who gets hypnotized by King Ghidorah?
Yes.
Yeah, there's Laura, there's Mona, and then there's Belvira. They all go through some shit, and they go through a big learning experience. It's very nice. Everyone's very pleasant. The movie begins. Asteroids hitting the Earth. Mm-hmm. No, that's probably not good. Very few movies begin with an asteroid hitting the Earth, and it's fine. If you notice that, it's always a blob or killer clowns from outer space.
Hang on. Trying to think of like.
I'm not saying it's never happened, but it's not the norm.
Has there ever been like a benevolent alien, Martian or something?
They don't really come in asteroids, though. I guess you could argue that like Superman, but that wasn't like an asteroid. Like, this feels like, well, maybe you know what? Maybe I'm being judgy. Maybe I'm adding my subjective quality. Like if it's a bad guy crash landing on Earth, it's an asteroid. If it's a good guy, it's a spaceship.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
That's a me problem. I actually have to deal with that. That's on me. I apologize for that. That's not fair. But in any case, a bunch of shooting stars are hitting the Earth, and we meet our human characters. There's a dad, and he's driving home with a watermelon in a baseball cap. The watermelon is in a baseball cap, not him.
Melons are a common gift in Japan. Mm-hmm. They're considered, it's kind of a luxury gift, from what I understand.
Yeah.
You can get special watermelons, special kinds of sweet melons, honeydews, cantaloupes, and you give them as, like, housewarming gifts.
Yeah.
So that's not so unusual that he's driving with
it. It's not a housewarming gift. He's bringing it home to his family. Yeah. But it is odd that it's in a cap.
I suppose so.
That was the thing that stood out to me. I thought maybe this was like a Howzy reference.
Oh no, my friend just turned into a watermelon.
That happened in the movie Howzy, which if you've ever seen Howzy, you must.
It wasn't a watermelon, though. It was bananas.
No, but there was a severed head that was confused for a watermelon or vice versa, so it's a little bit of both.
Oh, well...
Wasn't there a severed head watermelon gag in Howzy?
There was a flying severed head
in Howzy. But isn't there a watermelon... Okay, maybe I'm just remembering it wrong. In any case...
She was trying to chill a watermelon in the well.
Yeah.
When she fished it out, it was a severed head.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. I knew it was a gag. Meanwhile, over at Infant Island, all the Elias have cute new outfits.
They get new costumes every movie.
But the last one, the change was kind of subtle. This one feels like a major step up.
And was it Garagara, the little mechanical dragon?
Garagara, yeah.
Garagaru gets upgraded in every movie as well. Yeah. It gets like increasingly Borgified.
Yeah, now it's got like visible rockets. Belvira's dragon mount has visible rockets on it, which I appreciate. I like, in this one, it feels like she's more of a gearhead. Like there's a bit where she's trapped under Garagara as he's been like taken out of commission by King Ghidorah, and she's just kind of like kickstart it like Han Solo with a Millennium Falcon, just like pulling levers and shit.
And now they have swords.
They do. They have swords now.
And I finally understand a gag that it was a joke they made in a South Park episode that preceded this movie.
Huh.
If you recall the Barbara Streisand episode from the first season.
I do. That was their big kaiju episode.
Might
have been the first one they ever did where they had like a significant fake celebrity appearances.
Yeah.
Like real celebrities, but like, not playing themselves.
Barbara Streisand came to South Park looking for this magical triangular widget.
Uh-huh.
Because she already had one, and when she joins two, she turns into Mecha Godzilla.
Well, it was Mecha Streisand, yeah.
Yeah. Why Barbara Streisand? That was just where our sense of humor was at the time. And they also hate Barbara Streisand.
I don't know why.
But yeah, other celebrities got involved. Sidney Poitier was in there, Robert Smith from The Cure, and Leonard Maltin were also kaiju in that movie.
Yeah.
Or in that episode. In this movie, Rebirth of Mothra 3, they also have little magical triangles.
Yeah.
They have Triforces.
That's the thing. I thought it was like a Legend of Zelda riff, because if you recall, this isn't so much a thing I think as much anymore, but back in the early days of Legend of Zelda, the big MacGuffin was the Triforce, and it was basically three triangles, and you would assemble it.
They were just these big magical tiles. Yeah. They were triangles. They just needed a magical shape. You could put it on an 8-bit game.
Yeah, yeah. And they've been... Not that that's gone away, but they used to make a bigger deal about how this is the Triforce of Wisdom, and this is the Triforce of Courage, and this is the Triforce of Power.
Yeah, yeah.
So you need all three.
You have all three, and you can do something.
Yeah. They are Wisdom, Courage, and Love.
That's right.
And it turns out each one of these little doohickeys, doodads, if you will, goobers, corresponds to one of the Elias. So there's one for Mona, there's one for Laura, and there's one for Belvira. On which one's supposed to go to which until the very end. Like, you'd think it would connect, but...
And they each have these little magical daggers
that
they keep on their belts. And when they affix these little triangles to their daggers, they turn into magic swords.
Like you do.
Okay,
I mean it's cool, I guess.
And right at the beginning of the movie they mix up the three triangles,
so
they're
like
able to magically enhance one sword but not the other two, because they're swapped.
So basically I believe it's Laura is the one who's supposed to have the triangle of love, but if Laura has the triangle of courage, it won't fit in her little dagger and turn into a magic sword. Oh, that's how unfortunate for her. Whoops. I realized something.
Because these swords have not been established, we don't know what that means.
No.
Just they have swords. And
they don't do a lot of sword fighting.
And as we got into a big conversation with the last Rebirth of Mothra, this is like the He-Man and the Masters of the Universe thing, where they're just sort of thinking up crap as they go along.
Yeah.
Just because it's like fun for a kid audience. Kids like magic swords, so now it's going to be in the movie.
Well, Well, people like trinkets. I mean, Sailor Moon had been going on for a while, but this is the late 90s now, had been going on for a while at this point, and that had a bunch of different magical doohickeys where it's like a magical compass, or like it's a magical wand, I think, which had like a little stick with the moon on it, and when you whip that sucker out, and it's something you can buy, when you whip that sucker out, there's a transformation sequence, and it saves you a lot of money in animation, because you're reusing that animation every week, and yada, yada, yada. I realize now there was a bit at the beginning of the movie, the very beginning, the very first thing, is a quote. It's like on the screen, you know, like at the beginning of like Kill Bill when it says, "Revenge is a dish best served cold," ancient Klingon proverb. The quote is, "Have hope as long as you live." Quotation, Mothra. You know, Mothra said that. Remember when Mothra said that? Everyone remembers when Mothra said that. But
it sounded more like, "Eve, Eve." But it translated.
Yeah. But then there's like a moment where there's like a glowy bit. And the glowy bit looks like a glowing crucifix. And that's like, the movie is like, Mothra. I'm like, Mothra is Christian God? Where are we going with this? And now I realize probably a sword.
Yeah.
That's probably a symbol for the sword rather than a crucifix, which is really not relevant to anything happening in this movie other than the constant state of rebirth Mothra is in, I suppose. But I don't think they're really going for it.
There was a little bit more of a mystical element to Mothra in the Showa films.
Mm-hmm.
Less so in the Heisei era, and definitely not here.
Like, Mothra has worshippers in the Showa films.
And Mothra is also a sacrificing god, will give until she is dead and reborn. She constantly gives of herself to save the world and save the people.
Mothra is making the sacrifice. It's not like people are like, sacrificing their livestock to Mothra.
No.
Just to clarify.
I mean, maybe they are, but that's not in the movies.
Mothra doesn't strike me as the bloodthirsty type.
No. Yes, I will help you, but feed me an infant. You know, it's not...
Well, it is Infant Island.
That's why I call it Infant Island. Oh, God. They have to feed babies to Mothra. Jesus. Mothra's baby hunger cannot be sated.
All right, we're moving on from that right now. I know we can get into the weeds, but let's not, shall we?
Mothra is not a divine creature any longer. Mothra is just like a monster warrior.
Well, it's a magical being.
Mm.
It is summoned through song, which I don't know the science behind that shit, so I'm pretty sure that's magic. They've got magic swords.
Hmm.
I think there's still magic going on, but it's less religious. It's less religious than it was.
Oh, and there's time travel, too. We'll get to the time travel.
Oh, we'll get to time travel.
There's dinosaurs in this movie.
Actual dinosaurs in this one, not like Godzilla swords. Actual dinosaurs. Nice little treat. But anyway, Belvira goes to do her own thing, and she's just like, a giant terrible thing is coming. Meteors hit the Earth. Well, I guess they hit the Earth are meteorites, but whatever. I took a class once in school. In schooling.
Move on.
Okay. Anyway, meet our family. It's a dad, and I couldn't tell for a while, because she keeps calling him, like, Papa or something like that, if that was, like, the eldest daughter or if that was the mom calling Dad.
That was the mom calling Dad.
It took me a minute. Right. But anyway, they've got a bunch of kids. The only one who's relevant is the oldest. His name is Shota, and Shota likes to cook. Mom is cooking. It's okay. Shota's like, chop the onions more fine, dash a lemon. Mwah. And Dad's like, oh, this is the most delicious thing I've ever had. Yeah, Shota just made it up. Oh, my God, Shota, what an amazing cook you are. And then the next day, when everyone's going to school, everyone's like, okay, we're all going to school. Why isn't Shota going to school? Oh, he's humiliated, embarrassed. Every day he goes to school, and he eats the lunch that his parents lovingly make for him. And it's such bullshit. Such inedible, if you will, bullshit. That he cries. It's so miserable. And his mom's like, well, but it's made with love. It is the only thing he hates. To eat something you hate is not nutrition. So he stays home and goes cave diving. This subplot, by the way, where Shota doesn't go to school for food-related reasons, and also he's got, like, Hannibal Lecter's palate. This perfect palate. never mentioned again. They make a big deal out of it. I don't remember a lot of that. Well, let me ask you a question, because this is we don't always watch the same version. Did you watch the dub or the subtitled?
I watched the subtitle version.
I watched the subtitle. They made a weirdly big deal out of it for like a scene. All
right.
And because it's the justification for why he's not at school, which is actually important later. Because Mothra is not the monster I meant to mention. King Ghidorah is. King Ghidorah wakes up. Ah, I'm King Ghidorah. Really sucks. Hate this planet. Gonna kill everybody. But first, I'm gonna kidnap all your children and put them in a giant bubble.
Yeah, King Ghidorah is a little bit of a different creature this time around. Mm-hmm.
Got different motives, at least.
King Ghidorah, it's explained, came to Earth tens of millions of years ago.
100. Like, it was like the Cretaceous period. Yeah,
in prehistory, and wiped out the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the dinosaurs are dead.
They specifically say King Ghidorah killed half of them.
Half the dinosaurs.
The other ones, I guess, died of grief.
The meteor.
Couldn't go on.
And then left. King Ghidorah left. Now, King Ghidorah has returned. There's been, prophecies and all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And this King Ghidorah, in true kid movie fashion, is more like a warlock.
Yeah.
Who kidnaps the children, stores them in a little dome, like a magic, a dome of magic.
And it's weirdly fleshy. Like, it looks like an eyeball without, like, an iris on it, but it's really bloodshot and
the kids are all put inside, and King Ghidorah can sort of, like, sap their life energy.
God, is that what they were getting at?
They're
kind of vague about it. He just keeps doing it, and then he just sort of hovers around the bubble, and the kids are like, this sucks.
Well, they're freaking out in there a little bit.
Well, wouldn't they?
They're getting tired. Like, their energy is being drained by King Ghidorah.
That would happen anyway if you don't give them a snack. They're all afternoon. They're kids. They need calories. I'm just saying, King Ghidorah could have just, like,
put in some fruit leathers or something.
Well, I suppose if he wanted to be nice. All the kids get, like, teleported away, and the visual effect that they use to teleport these kids, they don't just like vanish
there's a lot of really bad compositing in this movie. There's a lot of bad it's almost like video toaster effects. Like, they just sort of replace video clip art of kids that they composite into a shot. It looks really bad.
But there are these shots of, like, the hallways in a school, and a bunch of, like, the elementary schoolers are, like, running around. They're scared. Fine. And then they're, like, turned into visual effects, but they still, like, kind of pictures of kids. And the visual effect is just stretching them, like, lengthening, making them taller for a second, and then they disappear.
Yeah.
It's weirdly Lynchian. Like, it feels like like an Inland Empire kind of effect.
Oh, I saw that effect a lot in kids' movies. That kind of, like, squishing and stretching. Keep in mind, this is 1998. CGI is getting cheaper. We talked about, the Roland Emmerich Godzilla. That was like high-end studio CGI, and there's pretty good-looking CGI. The one thing I can't complain about in the Godzilla movie are the special effects. I don't like that it's all at night in the rain, but I think
it was pretty good.
For the time, it was pretty good. When you see the monster, it looks all right. This is like low-budget TV-level special effects. And that kind of stretch effect that you're talking about was really common.
Yeah.
Especially when, people would vanish. They kind of, like, stretch and bounce a little bit.
Yeah.
As they popped out of existence, and they'd add, like, maybe some, like, ovals or sparkles to indicate that they vanish.
There's a bit in this movie because the teacher is, like, left behind. And the kids all run to the window to see King Ghidorah flying overhead, and then they're gone. And the teacher's just, like, kind of horrified, like, what happened? And did you ever see The Drifting Classroom?
I don't know what that is.
It's another movie by
Nobuhiko
Obayashi, the guy who did Haozu, actually. And it's based on, I think it's a manga about a classroom of, a school full of kids that gets, like, pulled into a sinkhole. But instead of just, like, falling underground, they fall into, like, another dimension. Okay. And it's just this, like, school in the middle of a vast wasteland full of monsters. And it's, like, these kids and their teacher, and they're just trying to survive. And, like, all their parents are, like, looking down in the hole, like, trying to figure out, can we get down there? How do we, like, it's weird. It's if you've seen Haozu, you're like, oh, that's weird. I want to see more movies like that. Drifting Classroom. Really fucking weird. And I kind of thought that was the vibe they were going for. It was pretty popular. Like, I think the manga was pretty popular at the time. But anyway. Seek it out. You'll be like, the fuck is this? And that's the vibe. That's what we're going for. The kids are all kidnapped except Shota. Shota, who had been told just before his parents drove away, don't go in the woods. That's all we ask. You can stay home for food-related reasons. Just don't go in the woods. So he goes in the woods. And he goes cave diving because his pastime is exploring an unexplored series of caves all by himself. What is he, 13?
He's about that age.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that.
Did you do a lot of solo cave diving when you were a kid?
No, but I spent a lot of time by myself unsupervised. That's not uncommon for...
It's the cave diving I'm more concerned about.
Kids or kids' entertainment to feature children that have agency and who get to go on adventures on their own.
I'm not objecting to that. I'm just not sure cave diving is the thing we should be encouraging kids to do on their own. I feel like that maybe is a potential recipe for disaster.
If there are any kids listening, go spelunking. Just do it. Bring a single granola bar and a flashlight and go into a cave all by yourself. These are the safe things to do.
Okay.
This is sarcasm. Please don't listen to me.
Thank you. Jesus Christ.
Wick. Just so we're not taken to court over
Jesus
this.
Christ. Anyway, yeah, don't go cave diving, kids. Anyway, so Shota is miraculously left out of this whole shenanigan. Meanwhile, the Elias are saying to themselves, oh, well, we should call Mothra. It's earlier than usual, but we're going to call Mothra.
Yeah.
It's like 18 minutes into the movie. We're going to call the big gun. And Mothra shows up, and the Elias are also trying to, like... you know what? They're getting their hands dirty. Mm. They're trying to take on Ghidorah themselves. And as they're flying past Ghidorah on their little... their mini Mothra, fairy.
Fairy Mothra, yeah.
And they're shooting it with, like, little lasers. Not doing a lot.
They're
using the sword, but it, like, shoots lasers. All of a sudden, Laura and King Ghidorah lock eyes. And because this is an action movie and not a rom-com, that means Laura has just basically had her soul corrupted by King Ghidorah. And she turns on Mona. And this whole bit is weird. Laura ends up inside, like, the eyeball or whatever, and Mona is, like, left all alone with Shota, and Belvira ends up getting sucked into the giant eyeball full of kids as well. Weird fucking movie. So now Mona and the kid are gonna share their feelings about, you know, having siblings and
talk about kid stuff,
and also establish important things for the plot. Like, it turns out that when the Elias summon Mothra, and we talked about this, actually. We talked about how, well, we speculated, rather. Because when you summon Mothra, you sing a song. And there's choreography and everything. If you don't get it right, do you get less of Mothra?
Yeah, we've established that's where they have Fairy Mothra. They got a little one. That was their rehearsal Mothra.
But here, we're actually confirming more of that. Because Laura has been corrupted by King Ghidorah. Mm-hmm. Well, Mothra's only at half power, because it was powered by two of the Elias.
Right.
So now they're concerned that Mothra's not going to be able to defeat King Ghidorah, and King Ghidorah kind of really fucks Mothra up for a while.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a massacre, but it's not good.
And this is a pretty cool-looking King Ghidorah.
Yeah.
They've made, as we've commented before with Desk Ghidorah, the design is, like, a little more cartoony, like it's a little more broad and pointy. Yeah. It doesn't look animal. It looks a little bit more like a puppet.
Yeah,
like,
it's very expressive.
Like by design,
it's very expressive though. I like that.
And you think back to the way King Ghidorah looked in any of the previous movies.
Yeah,
and King Ghidorah had sort of like a loose floppy quality because they needed to dangle those three heads from cables.
Yeah,
and the cable technology has clearly improved. Mm-hmm. They've made King Ghidorah like a lot more, like, sleek and dragon-like. Most importantly, they've given him bigger feet, so like looks a little bit stompier and more threatening.
He looks a lot less top heavy, which really helps. Just it makes him look like more plausible.
The other King Ghidorah had like sort of a chicken body, like a big round body but little two tiny feet, and this one looks a little bit more like a stompy monster. I think this might be my favorite Ghidorah design. All
right.
Just because it looks most like a proper monster.
Okay.
But yeah, King Ghidorah and Mothra have at it, and King Ghidorah is winning, has the upper hand for a while.
It's doing quite well, but Well, it's still early in the movie, so we really can't do much about that. So let's see what we got here. It turns out there are 528 children missing. It's good that they counted.
But yeah, Mothra Leo fights King Ghidorah, and it's at this point that King Ghidorah's like magic powers start to influence Laura.
And Laura
falls under King Ghidorah's spell and starts to attack Maul.
Yeah, where were I covered that. I was a lot of order when I covered that.
But that this was the point when that happened.
And then
I think Belvira also gets trapped into the dome, and she's the one who starts to like. This is when she starts to have her turn to the good.
Yeah, yeah, because she realizes that King Ghidorah has to be stopped, regardless of her differences with her sisters. Meanwhile, because Mona is the only Elias currently powering Mothra, Mothra's like, I can't defeat King Ghidorah like this. So he goes to Mona and he says, Mona, what if I go back in time to the Cretaceous period when King Ghidorah showed up in the first place, back when he was like a teenager, I guess, and I'm going to fight him there, thus saving the whole timeline? And Mona's like,
I can do that.
Yeah, we have a song for that. I don't get to whip it out very often, but yeah, I got it in my back pocket.
And they
Shota, get on the piano.
And they transform Mothra into a monster that Toho has dubbed Lightspeed Mothra. So, different monster.
Yeah.
And Lightspeed Mothra is able to travel at the speed of light and travel back in time.
Yes. And so we go
back in time. It's the same set with a black backdrop.
Yep. Kind of a red sky, a little bit, almost like an old Star Trek Next Generation episode.
And there's some animatronic dinosaurs.
I think there's a few CG dinosaurs, but they aren't very good.
In like, there's like a few wide shots of CG dinosaurs, but it's mostly animatronic, like puppets.
And I
not suit actors. It's
no. Definitely puppets. And I swear to God, pretty sure that T-Rex was a Jurassic Park toy. I think they repainted it or something. I think I had that toy. I'm not gonna. And it's like hunting down Triceratopses. And there's this really hilarious bit where he's like biting the Triceratops, but under the Triceratops like head fan, you know, the smart place to bite a Triceratops. And then King Ghidorah shows up and is like, "Hey guys!" And the T-Rex and the Triceratops are like, "What?" As if the Triceratops is also annoyed to have been interrupted.
Yeah, we're busy.
Do you mind? And then King Ghidorah is like, no, I'm going to kill all the dinosaurs. And they're like, ah, shit. And then Mothra shows up, and he's like, ah, I'm Mothra. And he starts fighting King Ghidorah.
And this is another case where every time there's a monster fight, you get, like, a bigger monster move of some kinds. Like, oh, I didn't know Mothra had a head laser.
Yeah.
But now Mothra has a head laser and starts zapping people.
Yeah.
Or zapping Ghidorahs, anyway.
This is also one of those time travel movies where you go back in time, but we keep intercutting your adventures back in time with the present as if they're happening at the same time and not literally like 100 million years ago. So
that's fun. It's exciting to cross-cut.
So Mothra is fighting King Ghidorah, and it's like, oh no, can we help Mothra 100 million years ago in time today by undoing King Ghidorah's brainwashing and getting Belvira on our team to triple charge Mothra 100 million years ago, which is also right now.
They can send the energy back in time as well.
Yeah, but only to 100 million years ago, which again is also right now.
Time is moving forward at the same rate, whether it's now or 100 million years ago.
The time in San Dimas is always correct.
Look, this all makes sense to me. I don't know why you're complaining about these little inconsistencies.
Okay.
Well, 100 million years... Uh-huh. The two time frames in both time periods are always going to be second by second 100 million years apart. Got it? We're always moving forward in time.
Okay.
Even when we're in the past, we're moving forward at the same rate. Didn't you watch Tenet?
I think I did. You know, you haven't seen Tenet unless you've seen Tenet 8 times.
Yeah, and even then, you still haven't seen Tenet.
No, you probably haven't seen Tenet, actually. Hold on. So the parents start looking for the kids. This will go literally nowhere, by the way. We're just going to take up time.
There's a lot of panic in the present, and I think the idea is if Lightspeed Mothra can kill King Ghidorah in the past, mm-hmm. then King Ghidorah will suddenly blink out of existence in the present, sort of like mm-hmm. in Back to the Future.
Yeah.
It's not that, you know, it won't be causality, it'll be instantaneous.
Yeah.
So all of the things that are happening with King Ghidorah right now are still happening.
Yeah.
And once King Ghidorah is dead, then King Ghidorah will vanish.
Yeah.
The problem is, Mothra is a little too violent with King Ghidorah, and a bit breaks off. In the past.
Yes.
100 million years ago. So, like, a piece of King Ghidorah's tail lands on the ground and, like, burrows underground and stays there for 100 million years.
Yeah, that's going to come back to bite us later.
Literally.
This will be important later. Also, by the way, the process of sending a Mothra back in time has, like, turned Mona into, like, a statue.
She's like, oh, that's right. She turned into marble. Yeah, yeah.
Like laying down, like kind of like Snow White style at the end. And everyone's like, oh no, Mona. Well, shit. Okay. So it's up to Shota to get himself kidnapped by King Ghidorah. So he runs up to King Ghidorah and says, hey!
Right.
You forgot one!
You keep saying Mona. Her name is Laura.
No, Mona's the one. Mona's the.
Laura and Maul are the two fairies.
Really?
Yeah.
I wrote this down consistently wrong.
Oh, you kept on saying, you wrote it down as Mona.
I don't know how I kept doing this. All right, whatever, anyway.
Laura is the one that was possessed, and is the one that's turning into a statue.
No. The one that turns into a statue is not Laura. The one that turns into a statue is the one outside the bubble.
No, Maul does not turn into a statue. Laura, the one who was possessed, turns into the statue.
No. The one who's possessed does not turn into a statue. The one who isn't possessed turns into a statue because they use their power to supercharge Mothra back in time.
Oh, you're right. I totally mixed them up.
Okay, so... Okay,
that's on me. Oh, sorry.
I apologize to anyone trying to follow along on this podcast.
Look, we're...
I was at least consistently wrong. In any case, Shota gets himself teleported inside the weird... flesh bubble, and he finds the two, Elias Belvira and the other one, and the other one's still, and they've been like fighting, they've been like sword fighting, and Belvira's trying to like survive.
But Belvira's had a change of heart at this point. Belvira's like, no, this is wrong, I don't want to take over the world, I don't want anything to do with you, I want to help get rid of this monster, there's a greater evil here, I'm gonna be good now.
And it's pretty convincing, because it's not like she's, like, completely changed as a character. She's still, like, kind of a badass and a bit cynical, but she is not down with destroying the world anymore.
Yeah, and in fact, Belvira and Maul will... Or, and Laura, excuse me.
Yeah.
I mixed them up. Will get on the back of Fairy Mothra.
Yes.
And fly out together and do...
Summonings.
Yeah, do the summoning thing together for the first time.
When Shota is trying to convince Laura to shake off King Ghidorah's evil influence. He's a very, very convincing arguer. Laura shakes it off. And she has to sing to supercharge Mothra back in the past. And it's a big moment. And we're cutting from the present to the past, and I kept thinking about what this looks like exclusively in the present. I just burst in here into a giant monster's weird flesh prison, and I convinced a hypnotized fairy to stop trying to kill her sister so she can save the day. And what does she do? She stops and sings for a couple of minutes, and then it's like, that'll wrap that up. Can you imagine?
I you know what? It would all make sense. At that point, I'd take anything.
I'm just saying, without the cross-cutting, it's got to be weird. It would be like, you know, you break into the Avengers Tower, and it's like, Captain America, the Red Skull, is about to, like, destroy a building, and Captain America just, like, sings all of the Star-Spangled Banner, and he's like, that'll do it.
Really?
Really? Yeah. That was weird.
Oh, shoot. I need 5 diamonds and some mayonnaise. Like,
what?
That makes much sense, right? Look, this makes about as much sense as a comic book.
I suppose so. Anyway, Mothra defeats King Ghidorah in the past, but Mothra dies in the process because it's still called Rebirth of Mothra.
Hmm.
And we're saying to ourselves, oh no, Mothra died in the past, and now we won't have a Mothra in the present. We lost a Mothra. We needed those.
So yeah, Mothra died 100 million years ago, and King Ghidorah was... chopped up 100 million years ago.
But And I actually think this is actually kind of a fun, because I actually was like, oh, yeah, this is playing fair, actually. Because Mothra's been on Earth for forever.
Yeah.
It's established. It's an ancient being. When the Mothra from the future dies, a bunch of baby Mothras from the past see it and cocoon it so that it can heal itself. But well, it's that, so that is wounded.
The little caterpillars, which we haven't had in the Rebirth movies yet, have we?
No, we had in the first one.
Okay.
In the very first Rebirth of Mothra movie, there was the caterpillar for a little bit. But yeah, the caterpillar Mothra has cocooned the Mothra from the future. I guess they figured out what was going on. It must have been very confusing.
They all have the same soul, William. They're the same being.
Sure. The cocoon Mothra
You're not listening to the rules. They're laying it all out for
Whitney, the cocoon Mothra from the future.
Yes.
That's my point. And Mothra... But here's the thing. Mothra... You know, Mothra has been cocooned and healed itself before. Mothra's really fucked up this time.
Mothra's dead.
Mothra is going to take over 100 million years to get better. And in the future, when King Ghidorah starts fucking around again, all of a sudden, a mountain that was in the background the whole time cracks open, and that was Mothra.
That was Mothra buried underneath there, pupating for 100 million years, coming out as Armor Mothra.
Awesome, by the way.
The metallic looking monster.
They did that on Doctor Who eventually, like that exact same kind of plot point. Brilliant.
And how is King Ghidorah still around in the present? It turns out that piece that broke off.
Exactly.
Like, they killed King Ghidorah,
yeah.
But then they fast forwarded back to the present, and it seems like that little chunk grew back over the course of 100 million years. So King Ghidorah is also back in the present.
Whoopsie. So,
doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I don't remember what period there was when there wasn't a King Ghidorah in the movie. They didn't go into that timeline at all.
But in any case...
The time travel is a little fast and loose, but I get the egg. The egg was implanted underground.
Yeah, that was fair.
New Mothra comes out. New Mothra's got metallic wings, and there's this big rebirth sequence.
Very cool.
And it
kicks Ghidorah's ass.
It like, sprays metallic dust all over King Ghidorah and, like, flies through his chest and explodes him into a firework.
It does the Holdo maneuver, except it survives. Like, it's pretty cool, actually. Like, it literally punches through King Ghidorah's chest. And even King Ghidorah afterward, like, turns around, like, the did you just... Whoa! Yeah. Honestly, if I wasn't dead, I'd be impressed. And Mothra is saves the day. And by the way, Mona, fine. Fine. She wakes up.
Yeah,
she's awoken from her magical coma.
Well, they even say you can use your magic to awaken her.
And well, they use the sword. Yeah, is what they do. And so, and then she's like, "Oh, hey, what did I miss?" And Bavira's like, "Oh, I'm good now. But I still think you're dicks." And she flies away.
Which I like that. I like that kind of relationship. That's good.
That's the thing. I actually weirdly satisfied by the... Because Belvira was always like their sister.
Yeah.
And they always loved her, even though she kept trying to destroy the world. And so the implication was there must be some saving grace there.
Yeah.
Something about Belvira is worth
redeeming.
Is worth redeeming. And yet, they really could have, like, at the end of this thing, when, you know, the two LES who are always the heroes, you know, one's dressed in, like, you know, magenta, one's dressed in blue, and then all of a sudden, you know, Belvira's there dressed in green and she's totally subscribed. Nope. Still wearing goth shit, still flies away in a robot dragon, and she literally just says, "Yeah, we're never going to agree on anything, but I'm not evil anymore, bye." Like, fine. I'll see you on holidays. And we'll just go our separate ways the rest of the time. Nice. The credits roll. And again, we never got back to the lunch thing. Came up again.
Why are you so focused on this lunch thing?
Because they spent time setting it up.
I thought it was
going to be useful
it's
later.
It's setting mood. It's just sort of something that's happening at home to establish that these are people.
I thought it was going to be important.
They have a diet.
Later.
That's all.
I thought it was Chekhov's chef. Like, I thought he was going to... Oh, no. How do we stop King Ghidorah? Well, King Ghidorah hates saffron. Okay, well, I'm going to make a ditch with a lot of saffron. And he's going to be like, I don't like this anymore. Bye. And he fucks off. And he never comes back to our planet/restaurant again. And that would have been fine. I don't know anyone who hates saffron that much. But anyway.
I had saffron tea this morning.
Nice.
Yeah.
I like saffron.
Very good.
I don't know why I picked that. It just seemed like a fun spice. It's just, it's weird to set something up like, because it's very specific.
It's not set up, it's just something that happens in the movie.
No, because they need to, they're dramatically justifying why he isn't at school with the other kids, right? They need to establish that. Hmm. So there needs to be a reason for that. They could have picked any number of banal, uninteresting reasons that don't call any attention to themselves. He's sick. He's scared because he didn't study for a test and he doesn't want to get bad grades. He's being bullied. Anything that any kid could probably sympathize with or understand. But they chose, I'm embarrassed by the quality of my lunch so much that
they
don't cry.
Do it that
they
much.
Do. They do. The kid explains it to
one scene.
And it's so long, but it's not just one line. The kid has to explain it to his parents, and the parents don't get it for a minute. And the kid like shoves it back in their face, like, you don't understand. When food is made with hate, it's not nutritious. And I'm like, see, this feels like this big deal. I don't know why you. I don't. I'm actually amazed that didn't stand out to you.
I barely remember this detail. It's not presented in a way like it's going to be important to the plot.
Yes, it is!
It's not!
It totally is! They literally look at the camera and say, this will be important later. They don't do that. Anyway, that's Rebirth of Mothra.
It's kid-friendly.
Very kid-friendly.
These are all kind of... They don't blend together, but they're all very similarly toned.
Yeah.
So there isn't like one that you're gonna like over the other, unless there's like, if you like the pyramid one, if you like the Adventures in a Pyramid, that's the one you're gonna like.
Well, they each have different qualities. Like the first one has a lot more stuff like in the kid's house with like the fairy and Gutter Gutter like flying around and sort of like at David Dakota tiny monster fashion. Had a lot more of that. Had a lot more stuff with the family in general, where like the dad was like responsible for cutting down this forest, and it had this kind of ecological message. And then the next one was a treasure hunt with a Pokemon. So that had its own kind of vibe. And then this one's way more old school Godzilla monster fights. Like, it's just a lot of them.
Yeah.
Kind of nonstop once the thing gets going. But this one has a bit more character stuff with the actual Elias, which honestly is welcome. We spend so much time with them. Like, give them, like, something to deal with.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to just, well, Belvira's quite bad. Gonna have to put a stop to that. Great. I don't know. Do you have a favorite? Is there one you think is the better accomplished, you know, more effective, more fun?
I think I was just kind of blindsided by these movies, by kind of how childish they were.
Yeah.
How like, slick and low budget at the same time, kid-friendly.
Yeah.
It reminded me a lot of, like, bad 90s fantasy films I saw growing up.
Sure.
I think it's just of a piece of that, which is just this big miasma of cheap children's entertainment. Kind of hard to say. Like, there's not a lot going on in these movies. Yeah. They're not very sophisticated movies. Even when they go into sort of big... like, this one has the most ambitious story because it has the time travel plot.
Yeah, it's a bit more epic. Yeah.
But they're not paying very close attention to the time travel plot.
No, it makes no sense whatsoever.
It makes as much sense as the magical temple from the second movie.
Yeah, but the magical temple isn't like a paradox. It's just kind of silly.
Yeah.
You know, like...
I guess that's all I can say. They're kind of silly.
Yeah.
They're really... I imagine they'd be really amusing if you're, like, if you're a kid.
Yeah, yeah. If you're a kid and this is just on TV, this would probably grab your attention. I think the first one, because it has a little bit more variety in terms of what it offers, because, again, it starts kind of small, in the house, sister's been possessed, little monsters flying around, and then gradually gets bigger, and then there's more stuff. I feel like it's, like, a little better paced... Than the other two.
Because it's lowering us into the world for the first time.
Yeah.
So we get to build up to the crazy stuff.
And also the kids...
The sequels start with the crazy stuff.
Yeah, but also the kids in the sequels, you know, they don't... All the human drama, they're still there. They never really have much to do, but I feel like the kids, you know, there was...
Shota's a bit of a hero in this
one. He's a hero, but he doesn't, like, do a ton, you know? They probably could have solved the problem without him, but... I feel like in the first one, there was more conflict between the kids that was actually consistently maintained. Like, the little sister and the brother, you know, have a thing. You know, they fight their kids. More actual engagement with the parents, more problem-solving in the human worlds. Like, we have to, like, how do we travel on an airplane with a couple of magical creatures? We have to pretend that they're toys. Like, a little more thought went into it. I just feel like once the action kicked in Rebirth of Mothra 2 and 3, it's just action-y stuff. Yeah. And that's fine, but it can only hold my attention, like, really hold my attention for so long before my mind starts to wander and I'm wondering what happened to the lunch. Like, that's what it boils down to.
Maybe that's what's going on with Rebirth of Mothra 3. Because, you know, we say all the time, every movie, if you start picking it apart, you're going to find the plot holes. They're in there. Every plot has holes. It's rare that you find a script that is 100% tight. You know, like, Die Hard might be it, and even then you probably find
Die Hard's got, like, a few, like...
The issue is, if you notice that stuff, it means the film isn't engaging you in the film in the way it wants.
Exactly.
It's not involving you in whatever the human drama is, or whatever the action sequences are. Those things aren't grabbing you enough that your mind is wandering, and you're starting to question the story.
Exactly.
Maybe you were so unengaged by the children trapped underneath King Ghidorah's contact lens... You started to wonder, wait a minute, there was that scene earlier where they were talking about the food. Am I waiting on that? Is something going to happen with the food?
Maybe I just like food movies and TV shows. Like, you ever watch Food Wars?
I've watched a lot of cooking game shows.
No, Food Wars is an anime.
Oh, no.
Food Wars is an anime about...
Was this the one about the demon who gets a job in the Burger King?
No. That was The Devil is a Part-Timer. Good show. All
right.
No, Food Wars is about a bunch of kids and they go to this, like... really intense cooking school where everyone's got like their super cooking specialty and they're constantly challenging each other to like humiliating battles where they're having to out-cook each other. And the way you can tell someone's cooking is really good is if when the judge, whoever it is, eats the food, it's so delicious their clothes explode off their body. And this isn't a metaphor. This literally happens and is commented on multiple times. And they start screaming about how delicious it is and explaining in, like, exacting detail how a chef could accomplish this so, like, you at home could do it. Food Wars kicks ass. Like, Food Wars makes food fun. Like, you know what you're thinking. Food? Eh. Why? No. Food Wars... it made it a blast. And I just thought, because this, it felt like the kid was being set up to be this culinary genius. Surely that this would be introduced as such a factor of his character, they'd want to do something with it. Like, maybe it's like, oh, my dad wants me to go into the family business, but I want to be a cook. And then at the end, dad's like, you can be a cook if you want. It's fine. You saved the world. Like, fair enough. No, just dropped. Still mad. This is gonna bug me. It's gonna be one of those things.
I need to watch it again.
I think you do.
I need to pay closer attention to...
You do.
Whatever the hell is going on that I clearly missed.
Okay. Anyway, that's it for Rebirth of Mothra 3. The end of the Remothra... The Remothra of Birth. Yes. The trilogy is over. The Heisei era, of which this was technically a part... is officially over. We're done.
This is the last of it, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking to yourself, Ibsen Whitney, you're about to start the Millennium series, aren't you? You're wrong. Because,
We screwed up again.
I mentioned it earlier that we've been trying to go in chronological order, and every once in a while, someone points out, hey, you missed one. Technically, this one monster from this old movie that is pretty obscure eventually interacts with Godzilla. And we've gone back... and revisited ones that, like, interact with Godzilla kind of in one panel of a comic book.
Yeah.
We've been trying to be very, very thorough. And so I didn't feel bad about missing Half-Human. Apparently we missed a big one, though. Because next time on Thank Godzilla, it's Friday, we're going to go back in time. We're going to watch another Ishiro Honda movie. God, he was prolific. And we're going to be reviewing a movie... whose name I wrote down on a piece of paper. It is Gorath.
Gorath.
Gorath is about a planet that's going to collide with Earth. And oh no, how do we stop that shit? Well, apparently it's going to be a Gorath. And then Gorath will eventually come back in Godzilla Final Wars, which we'll get to pretty soon. Not right away, but a few weeks.
There aren't that many films in the Millennium Era.
Yeah.
And frustratingly, they don't all neatly connect up.
Yeah.
Some of them have different... There's one in the middle called... it's called GMK, Godzilla, Mothra, King Ghidorah, Giant Monsters All Out Attack.
Great name, by the way. My God, what a great name.
And evidently that one is separate from the other ones. Mm. Maybe you could fold it in, but it's like clearly a different Godzilla. Like has silver eyes and like big fangs.
It's like when Joker came out, but Ben Affleck was still Batman.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the same Joker. Exactly. It was its own thing. Yeah.
So, and then also Godzilla Final Wars, which is supposed to be the final film, because it's the 50th anniversary movie. Really shitty special effects in that one.
Yay!
A lot of that early 2000s ultra blue photography. It's the ugliest movie.
Oh, no.
It was done by Ryuhei Kitamura, who did, like, the Midnight Meat Train.
Versus, which is actually a very cool movie. Yeah.
A lot of really bad special effects in that one.
Hmm.
Where was I going with this?
I don't know.
That one too is also connected.
Its own thing.
Like they fast forward into the future a little bit, and the tone's really different. So some people say that even Final Wars is in its own continuity. It's really frustrating because you know, not that the Showa era had the greatest continuity, but at least they felt of a piece.
Mm-hmm.
These ones don't even feel of a piece. I think only a couple of the Millennium films are gonna kind of link up.
Bummer. Well, it's going to be interesting to explore them anyway. I've seen none of the Millennium films. Okay. I've seen clips, because like I saw like the bit where Godzilla fought Zilla from the Roland Emmerich movie.
That's from Final Wars.
Yeah, right? I've seen little bits here and there, but I've never seen any of these movies in their entirety. So this should be an interesting experience. I am very much looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to it in 2 weeks, because we have to go back in time.
Colin Firth, we have to go back in time.
Yes, like Colin Firth often did. You may recall... and the King's Speech, there was a deleted scene where it turns out that...
Where he talked about his breakfast.
Well, no, because what happened was... Yeah, he talked about his breakfast, but it turns out that the original premise for that movie was Colin Firth, the actor, has to go back in time and pretend to be that king. Because that king accidentally died, like, in ruined history. Like, he shouldn't have died there. So he's got to go and do the whole shtick. They cut that out because, honestly, it works without it, and it makes a little bit more sense. And honestly, apparently the right call. One Best Picture. Who knew? No, that's not true. There's one person who's wondering. I pointed out, someone was like, hey, name a time travel movie that isn't Back to the Future. First off, that is not hard. Secondly, all movies... are time travel movies.
Just traveling forward at the usual rate.
Well, yes.
No, every... What is it? I think it was Godard who said, like, every edit is a lie.
Yeah, every edit is a lie. Every edit is... Well, if it's all just, like, in real time and just cutting to, like, reaction shots, you're still jumping around in space. Like, that's not how you would experience that scene. You would have to turn your head and walk around them to get to that angle.
Mm.
So that's a lie. But also, all editing... either compresses or stretches time. Slow motion makes time last longer. That's time travel.
Mm-hmm.
Cutting from one scene like to another scene, like, oh, we have to go see Dr. Jacobson about the robot, and then the next scene they're talking to Dr. Jacobson with the robot. Well, we just cut the whole bit of them driving there. We just traveled through time.
Mm-hmm.
But also in a purely philosophical way, films are capturing moments in time that we can then revisit later. So whenever you watch an older movie, to some extent...
you're watching the past.
You're time traveling to... like, we watched Rebirth of Mothra 3. It came out in 1998. We just traveled back in time to 1998 to at least watch this work of fiction that was produced at that time. And you know what? That sounds like I'm being, you know, just kind of... semantical and ridiculous there. I actually think that's really cool. I actually think that's kind of magical, actually. I think it's one of the really, really cool things about movies, is the way that they do all of these magical things that we've come to kind of take them for granted. We shouldn't. Even the weird, silly ones are kind of magic. I think that's really great. I love you. well, nice little moment.
Thanks for having us here.
Yeah, thank you for joining us here at the Critically Acclaimed Network.
And because we're recording this, you're listening to us in the past.
This is also time travel.
It's like the light from the star that takes a million years to get to Earth.
Yeah. And if you want to time travel right now, by the way, if you are listening to this on the main feed, if you're not a patron, at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, you can listen to next week's episode about Gorath right now, because all of our patrons get all of our new episodes ad-free, and they get episodes of Thank Godzilla It's Friday 1 week early. So, that you're welcome for more time travel. It's great. We also have a lot of other exclusive shows and a lot of other things you can do over there, like vote for future episodes of the Iron List and stuff. So head on over. Everyone who can support the show at Patreon, we know it's not always easy. It's really hard right now. It means a lot to us that you want to help the show continue. And we couldn't if you didn't. So thank you. Thank you. Huge special thank you to all of our patrons in particular. And anyone else who wants to help the show going, subscribe if you haven't already. Leave us a review if you haven't already. That really helps. Like, that really, really helps. I cannot articulate that enough. You can also participate as well. We have a show, We've Got Mail, where we read your emails and answer your questions and respond to your criticisms. And our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net.
That's right.
And if you'd prefer to send us a piece of physical mail, which are guaranteed to be read.
We like that.
Yeah. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
And send us a letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yep. And we're on social media at Critic Acclaim, and I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And that is it for the podcast, which is ending now. Rawr.